deal recently flooding the medical literature on the diet-behavior connection, but it isn't just the medical literature, it's also lay literature as well. Here is something from Reader's Digest just recently. What you eat can affect your brain. This is in the lay literature, but in the medical literature, just a few months ago, very nice article in Internal Medicine News talking about the way that the diet affects the way that you think. This is an article that came out of Denver, tells about just how what you eat can affect your brain and the way that you think and the way that you feel about things. This same issue tells about more cereal, fruits, vegetables should be eaten in the Western diet. That too is a new day in American medicine. For so many years we have just said if you get plenty of vitamins A, B, C, and D and plenty of calcium and iron, those were about the only kinds of understanding that we had about nutrients. Everything else was sort of relegated to being unimportant, such as trace minerals and small parts per billion of a variety of nutrients that we now know does influence these tiny quantities. They do influence the way that we think and the way that we act and our productivity, even whether or not we are capable of having religious thought. Some of you are aware that with Dr. Feingold, who started talking about the way that the diet affects the behavior of children, was ostracized and criticized and belittled and persecuted because of his theories on the diet-behavior connection in children. But no more. People everywhere now are sitting up and paying attention and working on this matter of how diet does affect such things as hyperactivity and autism. Autism is a sort of withdrawn, psychotic type of behavior, flattened affect, that is, children do not show normal affections. They do not lean on their parents. They may have very little that they communicate. These children are called autistic children. And hyperactivity is a serious and widespread disease. Some say at least 15% of our children are involved in it. Others say 95% of our children are involved, at least to some degree. And when we consider the fact that hyperactivity is a modern society disease, in its present form it was simply not known 100 years ago. So there is something about our modern society that makes our problem with hyperkinetic children a modern society disease. Now, the associated publicity of hyperactivity and autism and dyslexia and other learning disabilities with education has been lacking. We have publicized about hyperactivity and autism and so forth, but we have not told parents how they could avoid what things we suspect are associated and how to avoid those things. And while not all of the items that we think to be associated with hyperactivity and autism have been proven to be, in the way that I look at things, since all of these things are dispensable and human beings lived for thousands of years very successfully prior to the introduction of these various things such as additives in foods and a variety of other things, we lived quite successfully before that, and all of these things are known to be dispensable, so why not just dispense with them and live in a very simple way? Because the rewards, if they are associated, are enormous. Now, along with various shades of brain damage which are obvious in children, there are certainly many individuals who have, while they do not have measurable deficits in their brains, they do have some definite deficits in their mental function. Such delicate things as in mental functioning as ambition and zeal and tenderness and compassion and the social graces and honesty, heterosexuality and religion and just a wide variety of other functions of the brain that can be adversely influenced by substances that are in our modern society. We do not recognize these, medically speaking, because of the fact that we can't measure them with the electroencephalograph, or we cannot measure them on our various psychological tests. And so they have been largely denied as being specific entities that could be influenced by things. And while it is true that some hyperkinetic children or hyperactive children do show some immaturity in their reflexes, poor coordination of their motor function cannot actually be measured. And so because of that, there are many physicians who simply refuse to believe that there is any influence of the diet on these children's problems. Even such things as drinking water can influence the way that the child is going to behave. Since personality disorders are associated with hyperactivity, it can be expected that certain psychometric tests would reveal a high risk of such sociopathic activity as alcoholism, homosexuality, hysteria, criminality, and this kind of thing. And it is indeed a fact that these very personality disorders are associated more frequently in adults who are hyperactive children. Criminality and teenage rebellion, alcohol and alcoholism and involvement in the drug scene, all of these are far more common in teenagers who are hyperactive children. So when the diagnosis of hyperactivity is made in a child, we should immediately take steps to eliminate all of those things that we know can be underlying environmental conditions or dietary conditions. Now, some of these environmental conditions in the home are such things as inconsistent discipline. And the finest thing written on discipline of children today is in what book? A book called Child Guidance. We've gone over that previously. Children who do not know whether something they will do will be followed by approval or disapproval find an irritation of the nervous system that leads them to a sense of insecurity, which they express, but it also leads to a certain buildup of pressure inside the brain that makes them of emotional pressure that builds up inside the brain. Immaturity on the part of the parents, alcoholism and drug abuse, the overuse of household compounds, such as cleaning compounds and the like, that can irritate the nervous system. These are all involved in children's problems. I feel that prior to taking the responsibility or even the possibility of bringing children into the world, parents should study all of these matters. They should try to decide what it is that might have an influence from their own genetics on the characters and personalities and productivity of their children, and decide whether or not they will bring children into the world. And they would not allow sentimentalism to influence their judgment on that. And most people can start thinking about how nice it would be to have a tiny little baby in the home, and pretty soon their judgment is clouded by their sentimentalism. But we should not allow sentimentalism to influence us on these most important matters, but a very rational decision should be made as to whether children are brought into the world. If parents are not willing to devote their next 20 years to their children, then they should simply refuse to bring children into the world. Now, it has been shown through biochemical studies that 70% of hyperactive children have abnormal glucose tolerance curves. Now, that means that they are either sensitive to some of their food or they are hypersensitive to the sugar that they take. In one study, hyperactive children between the ages of 5 and 12 showed improvement in test scores in 1/4 of children when food additives were simply removed from their diets. 1 out of 4. And yet, would you believe that the researchers who did this study refused to believe that there was any influence on additives on the children, even though 1 out of 4 was showed a great deal of difference just depending on whether additives were involved. This, I believe, is a part of what we are seeing in the commercial influence on the decisions made by researchers. Most children recognize that they actually feel better when they have additives, most hyperactive children, when additives are taken out of their diet, and they request that their parents will let them stay on that kind of diet, which is a great surprise to the parents because it often involves some of the favorite foods that the children have been accustomed to taking. However, many hyperactive children are finicky eaters. They are unwilling to eat fruits and vegetables, and they take mainly milk, cheese, boxed cereals, crackers, and white bread. That has been shown in surveys that have been done on hyperactive children. In the treatment of children, all artificial flavorings, coloring agents, and the natural salicylates should be removed from these children's diets. Now, flavoring and coloring agents should have a little bit of special attention to them because, as you know, the flavoring agents in particular are quite likely to be the aluminates, that is, some kind of salt of aluminum. Aluminum is known to have a number of adverse effects on the central nervous system. Those who are being dialyzed because of kidney failure will have often a condition called dialysis dementia. Dialysis dementia is a kind of insanity, which is associated in some ways with a syndrome similar to Alzheimer's disease, which in some people's minds is associated with a high aluminum content in the brain. It is a fact that there is a high aluminum content in the brain. What is still in question is whether or not there is an association between the high aluminum content in the brain and the Alzheimer's disease, whether this represents another one of these biases of researcher genius. We just don't know yet, but it is certain that the cells that are involved in the neurofibrillary tangles, which characterize the brains of Alzheimer's patients, that these do contain some 4 to 8 times more aluminum than nearby brain cells that do not show these tangled processes in their neurons. Now, the next thing that I mentioned here in the treatment of the hyperactive child, that the natural salicylates should be eliminated. Well, what are these? Well, a number of foods. Let me just read a partial list. Potatoes, cucumbers, peppers, tomatoes, apples, apricots, blackberries, boysenberries, cherries, currants, dewberries, gooseberries, grapefruit, lemons, melons, nectarines, oranges, peaches, plums, prunes, raisins, raspberries, strawberries, almonds, and grapes. Now, somebody might say, well, what's left? If you were to remove all of that, well, there are some fruits that are left, and you will find this list in our book called Natural Remedies in Appendix B, if you would like to have that. children who have hyperactivity should have the foods having natural salicylates in them removed from their diet for a certain period of time to see if they don't improve. And a certain percentage of children will show a dramatic improvement the very next day. We had one young boy who was a terror in his household. The household contained his grandmother, his two older sisters, and himself. His two older sisters were, the youngest one was about 5 years older than he, and so it was their duty to take care of this wild youngster while the grandmother worked. And when she came home, then she would take over, and the two girls who had been taking care of him since they got home from school would escape. They just felt that they had to get away. And the grandmother felt that she had to get away too, but she was trapped. So one time, one year after she had put up with this for 3 years, by the way, he had been a model child during his first 5 years. It was at that time that his two older sisters and himself lived with their parents. But the family broke up through divorce, and the mother sent the children to live with the grandmother. The grandmother already had a career of her own by that time. She didn't want to lose her job, so she just provided a lot of foods that the children liked for them to get their own supper while she continued working, and the television was largely their babysitter. So when I went over these things with the grandmother, she began to recognize that, yes, it was when he came to live with me that his personality deteriorated. And as she traced back, she began to think, well, yes, he was a model student the first 2 years of his schooling, and he has been a terror the last 3 years, but that has been since he came to live with me. We all thought it had to do with the breakup of the family, but maybe it had to do with the diet, with a change in diet. She changed his diet, changed his schedule, changed her manner of handling him. And about 10 days after she had started in this program, she called me very disturbed one day. She said, Dr. Thrash, there is something terribly wrong with Jamie. I says, what is that? I was worried immediately with the sound of her. She says, he has slept for the last 3 days. He goes to bed. He wakes up only to take his whole wheat toast and his fruit, and then he goes back to bed and goes to sleep again, and I can't wake him up. He must have a sleeping sickness of some kind. And I drew a deep breath and said, he needed it. He's had three hyperactive years. He needed to be very quiet and to get plenty of sleep for a time. Now, not all cases will be as dramatic as Jamie's was, but many will be, and it is always well worth the trial to try to help the child with that. Also, not all parents are as readily convinced as this grandmother was. Most American parents still feel that the diet cannot really have an influence on the central nervous system. Now, there are other items in the life of the child, especially in the prenatal life, that can affect hyperactivity, such things as prematurity, difficult and hasty or precipitous labor, a blood incompatibility, the adoption of a child. Now, whether this has to do with prenatal influences or whether it has to do with the fact that the child is put with parents who may not understand the ways of handling a child that comes from another family, we simply don't know all about that kind of thing. But all of these may influence hyperactivity, and they are being considered right along with the diet, and they should be. Signs of developing hyperactivity can be such things as tiptoe walking, ambidexterity after the age of 7. Now, children are early on ambidextrous, although they may show a preference for one hand or the other. But by the age of 7, they should be pretty definitely oriented toward either right or left hand. The likelihood of a learning disability or autism is as follows. with one or two of these historical factors that I've mentioned, the child is suspect. With three, there is a strong evidence, and with four or more of these, it is almost certain that the child will develop hyperactivity or autism. So what you must do in considering how to treat a child is simply go back in his history and find out how many of these things are operative in his experience, and then be very certain that you don't allow anything that can be controlled, that is not already a part of history, to come up in the life of the child. Such things as anemia, iron deficiency anemia, can be a cause of a problem. This may result because of lack of exercise, lack of sunshine or outdoor experience, or white flour products, even when they are iron fortified, because many people cannot properly assimilate the iron that has been used to fortify cereals. Then, of course, the brain hormones can be involved in an iron deficiency anemia, as well as in some kind of deficiency of proteins. Now, since in the refining of grains, proteins are also removed. The germ of wheat contains very good quality protein. If that is taken away, then certain amino acids may be lost to the child, and this may result in a behavioral problem for the child. If a woman smokes during her pregnancy, this greatly increases the risk that the child will be hyperactive or will have autism. In our home birth program, we would not accept a woman who smokes during her pregnancy. We felt that the risks of her having some unwanted outcome of her pregnancy were simply too great a risk for us to take, so we would eliminate those from our program. A 3 times greater likelihood of hyperactivity develops in a child if the mother smokes 23 or more cigarettes per day as compared to a woman who smokes none. Now, the drinking water that goes into the home is also of an important factor. In one study that was done, the drinking water which went into the home, that is just taking the water as it was going into the home, getting into the house, had more than 2,000 micrograms per liter of lead as compared to 800 micrograms, which is more like the normal. Mental retardation was also associated with the higher lead levels of water going into the house. Even a mild degree of lead poisoning in rats has been associated with a decrease in the production of dopamine, which is one of the brain hormones that we use to transmit nerve impulses from one nerve to another. In one study, hyperactive children showed a higher blood and urine levels of lead than did controls who did not have hyperactivity. Now, all of these things can help parents to see that there is much that is known today that can be used to judge whether your child is likely to be hyperactive, and some things that you can control. Not everything about our lives are uncontrollable that make us what we are. Now, in the book Diet, Crime, and Delinquency by Alexander Schaus, we find a number of chapters that are quite interesting. The chapter that we have on sugar and antisocial behavior. This is quite an interesting little chapter. If you have the book Nutrition for Vegetarians, you might like to turn to page 40. And there you will see that we have a table showing the sugar intake and its influence on white blood cells. Now, white blood cells are easily studied. What we do is to take a sample of blood from the arm and spin it down remove the layer of white blood cells when we have centrifuged it. And there we take those white blood cells, incubate them with germs for 30 minutes in a moist chamber. And then at the end of the time, we simply stain them up and count how many germs are in each white blood cell. Normally, 14 germs will turn up in each white blood cell. But if you will look at the little table there, you will see that if a person takes a mere 6 teaspoons full of sugar, that it will reduce the number of germs that his white blood cells can eat in 30 minutes by 25%. Or from 14 down to 10. If the person takes 12 teaspoons full of sugar, it will reduce the number of germs that his white blood cells can eat down to five and a half. And if he eats 18 teaspoons full of sugar, it will go down to 2 in half an hour. And if he takes 25 teaspoons full of sugar, his white blood cells can only eat 1 germ in half an hour. Now, this is with white blood cells, but what about with our brain cells? Do they also act in the same way that the white blood cells by reducing their efficiency? And the answer is an overwhelming yes based on the modern studies that have been done just in the last 15 years mainly on children and mainly in a crime situation, delinquent boys and delinquent girls. And in this book by Alexander Schaus, Low Blood Sugar and Antisocial Behavior, he tells about a Dr. William Hudspeth, a researcher at the University of Nevada in Reno, who has demonstrated that sugar can cause a whole range of behavioral symptoms, depression, hyperactivity, and acting out types of behavior that can be extremely antisocial or even asocial, just showing no regard whatsoever for any kind of social customs or what is compassionate for other people. Consumption of sugar in the United States has increased dramatically in the last 150 years. What effect has this had in the central nervous system, and particularly in children's health, is the subject of a good bit of controversy nowadays and a lot of study. In 1822, according to Alexander Schaus, we used only 2 teaspoons of sugar per person per day. By 1870, that was 11 teaspoons full. 11 teaspoons full. Think of that. It's almost revolting to consider eating 11 teaspoons full of sugar in a day, isn't it? It would make you sick at the stomach to eat 11 teaspoons full of sugar. Well, that was in 1870. At that time, Ellen White said we were using far too much sugar. Far too much sugar. She wrote about that. Far too much sugar. 11 teaspoons full per day. Well, by 1905, it had gone up to 22. By 1970, to 32. And in 1980, it's more than 38. Well, that's just almost unthinkable, isn't it? Who eats 38 teaspoons full of sugar in a day? Well, somebody eats far more than that because they eat mine too. And I'm sure some of you could say the same thing. They don't eat all of mine, but they eat the most of it. I certainly don't get even the 1822 average. Now, if we just focus on a study like the one that has been done on white blood cells, we can extrapolate that to practically all of the cells in the body. What about the bone cells? Are they not stable and static so that it wouldn't matter what we eat? No, they can be adversely influenced also by the sugar. Do you suppose that the sugar intake has a lot to do with our epidemic of osteoporosis in this country? Well, surely it must. And so, instead of focusing on the intake of a certain thing, we should actually start looking at what we can eliminate from our dietary that we know to be injurious. So injurious things are usually not injurious to a single thing. Overconsumption, malnutrition, is a major health problem. Now children are substituting snack foods and processed foods for the traditional staples of vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. And this is leading to an increase in the rates of obesity, high blood pressure, and hardening of the arteries. Now the Kola, Q-O-L-L-A, Indians are about the most unpleasant and unlikable people on the face of the earth. They live in Peru. The majority of them are mean people, criminal people. In one study over, in one village, over 50% of the adult males had been involved one way or another in a homicide. The majority of the Kola people engage in some form of criminal behavior, and every form of criminal behavior known is a part of their society. Murder, rape, arson, fighting, stealing, and so forth. Now, they took these men and did laboratory tests on them, and they found that half of them, over half of them, had low blood sugars. This means that they are sensitive to sugar, and they do consume a lot of sugar. They also take in a low-protein diet. Most of their diet is made up of sugar, refined sugar, like from sugar cane, and they also drink a lot of alcohol and chew the cola. They chew cola. And that, of course, makes them so that they are frequent fighters and they don't enjoy living with other people. If you ever pull up to a traffic light and you're sitting there waiting for the traffic light to turn with your eye glued on it, and the instant that it turns, somebody behind you honks his horn, you can say that he is under the influence of caffeine. He just simply cannot wait even a split second for you to get your car into motion before he is notifying you about it. You can be certain that he is under the influence of cola. Cannot stand to wait even a second. This is the kind of impatience that a lot of Americans show. Just cannot stand anything. They have no tolerance at all for other people and no compassion. One man had been in jail 7 times for disorderly conduct. This was not among the Kola Indians. This was in Saskatoon. When he was examined by the prison physician, a Dr. Thacker, during his examination he began to perspire very heavily, and suddenly he pulled out a 2-pound jug of sugar and started consuming that in fairly large quantities. And he told the doctor, quote, "This is the only thing that keeps me well." Then when he was tested, it was found that he had a severe case of hypoglycemia. He was placed on a diet. Now he had been in a 10-year period, he had been in jail 7 times. Over the next 10 years, he had not one single arrest. In fact, he turned out to be a model citizen just by putting him on a diet. Dr. Seal Harris reports on a study that he has done. The brain, although only 2% of the body weight, uses close to 50% of all the available glucose or blood sugar in the blood. So any sudden changes in the blood sugar level would affect the brain. Dr. Harris noticed that some people would experience the same symptoms without receiving insulin, even though their blood sugar went high. They themselves would produce a large quantity of internal insulin, and of course what happens is that the blood sugar immediately plummets, and that causes the hypoglycemia. This is called reactive hypoglycemia. Free sugar, quickly absorbed, stimulates the body to release its insulin. Now, there is almost always a stomach problem involved in people who suffer from reactive hypoglycemia. The normal stomach will not allow sugar to be put into the small bowel quickly, and consequently, the stomach, holding on to it and only metering out the contents of the stomach containing a large quantity of sugar, can control how high the blood level gets with sugar. But most people's stomachs have been damaged to the point that the stomach is no longer able to perform this very delicate function. When is it that we damage the stomach to this degree? Early in life. It may occur even in our infancy. Now, the ingestion of a food to which the person is allergic can also cause these wide swings in blood sugar. And a part of that is the fact that there is a speeding up of the emptying time through the stomach in individuals who are allergic. Now, there are 10 questions that a person can have to decide whether or not he is hypoglycemic. Let me just read what Alexander Schaus has recorded in his book. Number 1, headaches. Number 2, stomach or intestines are upset. Number 3, faintness, dizziness, or weak spells or cold sweats. 4, being tired or exhausted. 5, I often forget things is a complaint. Number 6, they feel sleepy during the day. Number 7, they feel depressed. Number 8, they get blue feelings over nothing. Number 9, they feel nervous. And number 10, they are drowsy. Well, all of these symptoms can be signs of hypoglycemia. Persons who respond usually or occasionally to 4 or more of these 10 items show a high consumption of white sugar, refined carbohydrates, and caffeine. Among chronic juvenile delinquents, this consumption has been as high as 75 hidden and 20 frank teaspoons full of sugar, making a total of 95 teaspoons of sugar per day. Now, sugar is just added to many foods, and Alexander Schaus goes into those foods to which sugar has been added. Some things that you would just simply never think about, like gum or fruit juices that are marked unsweetened, and the government will allow unsweetened orange juice to be sold if the manufacturer does not add more than a certain quantity to bring the total carbohydrate level no higher than a certain level, which is described by law. So quite a good bit of sugar can be added, and still if the total carbohydrate level is not exceeded, it is simply bypassed and nothing is said of it. Now, that isn't all on the sugar question. It is just an introduction to the sugar question. But I'm sure that by this little introduction that I have made, you will be alert to the fact that sugar can cause a great deal of problems in our ability to fight disease, in the personality expression, in our professional productivity, and in our moral advancement. It is an important thing. Generally speaking, sugar should be eliminated from the diets. We should go back to what we were in 1822. How many teaspoons was it in 1822? Now, if you had lived prior to 1822, it is unlikely that you would have consumed more than 2. Now, what do you suppose that people had as their attitude toward their food prior to 1822? Do you suppose they wished for death, thinking that their food was so insipid and unpalatable that they just would rather die than to keep on eating their food? You suppose that was their attitude toward their food? No, indeed. They enjoyed their food just as much as we do today, maybe more. So let's go back to a more natural diet and see if that has been provided for us naturally is not just as satisfying or more so than that we now think we just cannot live without. I have referred to lead just a little bit, and I would like to talk with you about what Alexander Schaus has to say about lead. Now again, this is not the only thing that can be said about lead. Schaus just gives a little bit of an introduction. But I'd like to bring out two things that he says. One is a case report. This is a case report of a boy named Tony. Tony was 21 years old, and he was being held in the county jail. He had been arrested for battering a police officer. In fact, that was a favorite pastime of his, just beating up a police officer. But he also enjoyed creating a public disturbance. He always resisted arrest, and he could not get into his car and take off like normal people. He was always driving recklessly. During his court arraignment, he was disoriented, disruptive, and completely irrational. Given his mental condition, the judge ordered the probation department to evaluate the man's ability to remain locked up in the county jail. A psychiatrist and the probation department's mental health specialist interviewed the subject over a 3-day period. The psychiatrist diagnosed the man as acutely schizophrenic, while the mental health specialist asserted he was a full-blown paranoid schizophrenic. Both predicted that his condition would continue to deteriorate with age. The probation officer was informed that Tony would become a vegetable by the age of 30 because of his long criminal record, which started at the age of 11. Tony was held in jail while the probation department prepared its recommendation to the court. Tony's probation officer suspected his bizarre behavior might be due to lead poisoning. Now, the probation officer is just an ordinary person, not specially schooled like these two psychiatrists who had already examined him were. The probation officer consulted with the prison physician, and they ran some blood tests and urine and hair tests, and what do you suppose they found? A very high toxic levels of lead. They also found very high concentrations of mercury, cadmium, and arsenic. Now, I'll tell you in a little bit where we are likely to get all of these heavy metals. Tony's mother revealed that when he was a little boy, he ate mostly refined foods, consumed oysters and clams, and many times raw from nearby beaches, which he would himself pick up. And at that time, the family lived downwind from a large metal refinery that released toxic heavy metals in abundance. She went on to state that when he was in elementary school, the school authorities labeled him as both learning disabled and behaviorally disoriented. Well, they corrected his lead level, and Tony became a different individual. Now, he was never as smart as he could have been, because sometimes when the nervous system is damaged by heavy metals early in childhood, we remain not so smart, but at any rate, we can get to the point where we are not criminally disoriented, as was Tony. Now, with children having high blood levels, teachers often report that they have the following types of behavior patterns. And just listen to these. These describe a large proportion of modern school children. Distractibility, lacking in persistence, constantly dependent and clinging, impulsiveness, easily frustrated, daydreaming, inability to follow simple directions. They fail to follow a sequence of instructions. So that if you say, do this and then do that and then do something else, they are unable to do that. By the way, that's a good exercise for your children in mental development. Give them several items to bring to you from various parts of the house in the order that they should bring them. You can tell whether they do it because you tell them one thing to bring from a distant point and then another thing from another point and closer and closer to you, and then give them a time limit on how long they are allowed to take before they bring it to you. And often, children, you can discover whether or not your child might have some heavy metal intoxication by whether or not they can follow a sequence of orders. About seven, about the age of seven. But even earlier, some children can show very good ability to remember five things in sequence. Now, let's study some potential lead sources. Of course, lead smelters, we would think. But what about automobile exhaust? That's an important cause of high lead levels. And children who spend a lot of time around automobiles or motorcycles tend to have higher blood levels than do others. So it is best for us to keep our children at home in a protected, pure air environment. Storage batteries, porcelain enamels, dirt and dust, newsprint, varnishes, pigments, paints. Yes, they do still have lead. Spitballs, cosmetics, such as mascara and the like. Cigarettes, pottery glazes, heavy-duty greases, solder, lead pipes, bullets with lead shot, vegetables growing by roadsides, hair colorings, that is, to remove gray, pencils, plaster and putty, painted glassware, children's toys, linotype metals, products with metal parts containing lead. These are some that Schaus lists in his list. Now, I'm sure that you can see by these things that we are living in a society that has a serious problem so far as its pollution is concerned. Now, let's take a few questions. Can the transition from a three-meal plan to a two-meal plan cause transit time for elimination to increase for a while until the system adjusts? And the answer is yes. It can cause constipation. It can cause an increased transit time, even when there is a daily bowel movement, because of the fact that there is a delay in eliminating the refuse from a certain meal. May take several days for a certain meal to be eliminated, and still the person may be having a daily bowel movement. The transit time can also be decreased so that one goes below 6 hours by a change in the diet. So either way, a person can have a change in his transit time. Are immunizations considered drugs? Yes. Are they safe? No. But the question is not whether they are safe. It is known that there is some risk involved in taking immunizations. The question is, and the issue is, which is the most dangerous? Taking the immunization or having the disease? And this is the question that a parent should face. You should evaluate yourself. What is your position? Are you in a high-risk group? Do you live in crowded conditions? Are you ignorant of basic hygienic principles? Is your diet a very poor one? All of these things should be taken into consideration as to whether you would immunize your child. Bearing in mind also that all of these factors may injure your child more with the immunization. So the important thing, it seems to me, would be to get yourself in the most ideal position and still not use the immunizations. But every person needs to consider his own position. Now, most people did not know that immunizations were not entirely safe until all this came up about smallpox. There is no smallpox today. So when smallpox was sort of died out, it died out not because of our immunizations. Far from it. There was never a time that we had more than 40% of the world's population. Not even our best year did we have as much as 40% of the world's population immunized. And More conservative estimates put it at around 8 to 10% immunized against smallpox. So it was certain that it was not the immunizations that caused the dying out of smallpox, but it's just that smallpox goes the way of all diseases. We have ups and downs in diseases and always have, and I suppose we always will, just like the Black Plague that killed 4 out of 5 people at one time, and the swine flu that killed a large, in some cities, would kill 4 out of 5 people back in the 20s. But you never hear of swine flu now, except its political implications. There are occasional cases of swine flu, but it's just not the lethal disease that it used to be. Syphilis has had its ups and downs. During the Middle Ages, apparently what was called the White Plague was syphilis, and it killed large numbers of people. But people don't die from syphilis now, not usually. So we can see that disease does have its cyclic pattern. And now the question is also asked, do you recommend them? Well, I really don't take a position for or against the immunizations. What I do say is that each case is a case unto itself and should be studied, and the parents should be the ultimate judge as to whether or not they will immunize their child. This should not be the pediatrician, because it is a fact that the bulk of pediatricians' income is from the well baby checks and the immunizations which they give, and of course that means that he might not have an unbiased opinion. Yes.
I'm sure you're aware of, like in England, they do not start immunizations until 6 months old, while here we in America start them at, they recommend it 2 months.
Yeah. Well, it's when you go for the 1 month checkup that many pediatricians start.
While in England, they have less problems with lack of immunization than that. I read a report where they said it was because of the development of the system nervous system in the body.
The immune system is the. Yeah. The immune system does not get into high gear until about the age of 3. And my personal recommendation is that if you do plan to give immunizations, that you not even consider it for the first year, that the child be breastfed and protected from exposure. And that this will go much farther than the immunizations toward protecting him. Because the nervous system, the immune system is not well enough developed so that it can actually profit from immunizations as well before the age of 1. Then the time that you would really consider it would be at the age of 3 years. A lot more could be said on immunizations. If you would like to have probably the most scholarly presentation on the con side of immunizations, you should get a little book called How to Have a Healthy Child in Spite of Your Pediatrician. That is written by a man named Robert Mendelson, and he very ably presents the matter of not having immunizations. He is very much opposed to mass immunizations. While I'm on this subject, I might just tell you about polio. There is no polio in America today, no paralytic polio, except in people who are being immunized. The immunizations do cause a certain number of paralytic polio cases every year. But apart from that, we aren't having any polio. It's just gone through this cyclic thing, just like a lot of other diseases do. But there is still a push to immunize everybody against polio. But I see no necessity at all to immunize people against polio. I say what we should do is to educate people against filth. Polio is a filth-borne disease, and if we can learn how to handle filth, then we should not have any more problem with polio.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.